Welcome to the Cis Lunar Experience. I'm your host, Vincent Maroli. On this episode, our team traveled to sunny Burbank, California to sit down with some team members from Honeybee Robotics. Honeybee is, well, a robotics company, like the name suggests. They've been building hardware for NASA and the space industry since 1983, and their principal focus is on geological research machinery. They built multiple different types of drills that aid in resource prospecting and have a myriad of space resource technology that's either in development for the moon or has already actually flown to the surface of Mars. So they've been doing really cool stuff. This is actually the first of two episodes with Honeybee. And we veered off business for actually a little bit of the discussion. We talked about like future social trends and how those may or may not, you know, expand or contract as we go up to the moon. You know, what is homelessness and depression and the effects that those have on society? What does that look like in a lunar colony? I had never thought about that before, but we discuss it here. So really had an incredible time with Hunter Williams from Honeybee Robotics. I hope you do as well.
Well, 3, 2, 1. Hunter Williams, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you coming on. So how long have you worked here at Honeybee Robotics?
I've worked at Honeybee for 3 years so far.
Okay, gotcha. And before that?
I was a NASA research fellow before that, and then I worked at Lockheed Martin at Cape Canaveral before that. So, yeah, I've been in the aerospace industry for a little while.
Yeah.
But I'm very happy at Honeybee. This is the first job I've ever had where I have thought to myself, you know, I don't need to move on. I think I'm good.
Nice. Yeah. So, okay, so been in the industry for a while. How'd you get the space bug? Like, where was that part of your story?
I got the space bug by reading. I was a reader my entire life, right? So nice. I can definitely say I got the space bug by reading. But in particular, I made my big career change based on reading The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And I had this, Robert Heinlein book, you know?
I've heard of this, but I have not read it yet.
It's got a lot of very interesting things in it, which I'm happy to talk about, but
sure.
The main way that it inspired me was that it talked about how, like, it presented a potential future mm-hmm. that was not super far flung, you know, no new engine drives developed, right? It's
gotcha.
Something that it's a future that could be possible for us with the same technology development path that we're on now. So I thought to myself, you know, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm really meant for. Kind of like a burning bush moment, so to speak. Right.
Yeah.
So I was living in Japan at that time teaching English, and I quit my job.
Wow.
And I went to community college to see if I could actually do math, because I hadn't taken a math class in 10 years at that point.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I enjoyed it. So I went back to school for engineering.
Dang. Okay. And you were in Japan just like Teach for America kind of thing, or?
I was a freelance English teacher, I guess you could say. So I didn't go with the program, you know. I had taught in China before that.
Dang.
So yeah, I've been a teacher. I was a teacher in my previous career. I taught English, I taught Spanish, I taught remedial math. So yeah, it's funny. I don't know how much that transfers over into my current job, except that I find that a lot of times with hardcore engineering concept, it needs to be broken down in such a way, even to technical people, that they can understand what they can catch your vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
Too much jargon, too much technical stuff ends up clouding what should be, simple concepts. So in my job, my role is as technology development manager. So it's kind of half technical and half business development. I talk to our partners at NASA and at, in industry and academia, and try to figure out where we can build some things together. So Honeybee doesn't really do, go out and like sell stuff so much.
Right.
We do, we build stuff up from nothing, and it's a lot of fun because, you know, we get to dream. So a big part of my job is simply dreaming up the technologies that are coming up next.
Okay, yeah, that sounds real fun.
It's good. That's why I don't want to leave.
I like, yeah, I've got a, I just redid my Google Calendar, and on Saturdays I put out a big block of dream about the future.
There you go. Yeah. That sounds good.
Not getting paid for that part. Well, maybe. Depends on how you measure it out.
One day, right?
Guaranteed. So, okay, so now you're more focused on dreaming, on creating that partnership between NASA, JPL, people like that, and Honeybee. Because a lot of what you guys do, and we just touched this briefly with Chris, it's not like, hey, here's a product, we've made 50 of them, let's go sell them. It's more R&D research pretty exclusively, right?
Yeah, it's like we talk to NASA and talk about what's coming up in the future. Like, what are the missions that you guys are kind of early stage thinking about right now? What is the science goals of the nation? And where do we need instruments, but also where do we need things that will interact with the surface in order to get the instruments what they need? So Honeybee, oftentimes we start with here's probably like the state of the art with what's coming up next for planetary science. You know, this instrument is kind of in its infancy, so we know it's going to develop along such and such line, or we may be thinking about funding these kind of spectrometers, for example, right?
Gotcha.
So what do they need? Do they need to touch the surface? Do they need material to be carried to them inside of a box somewhere, right? And then on the other side, that's kind of our astrobiology side of the house, our looking at signs for life through the solar system, looking at surface science.
Gotcha.
On the other side of the house is the development of future space resource utilization technology. Mm-hmm. So Honeybee's motto is touch life, mind the sky. Touch life refers to all of that very hard science type stuff.
Fly to Europa in 50 years, such and such.
For sure. That's Chris's big dream.
Yeah.
Also all the Mars stuff that we've done, you know, Honeybee was the first to touch the inside of a Mars rock. Honeybee was the first to get a sample of ice on Mars. And a lot of that was directly related to the search for life on Mars.
Gotcha.
When we did touch the inside of a Mars rock for the first time, we revolutionized the understanding that we had of the Martian water cycle. We didn't find life. We were hoping to find life, but we found something else that was very interesting. But
So, you said touch the inside of rock, like, hey, here's a rock, we've driven over them, now we're going to drill into it?
Yeah, we abraded away the surface.
Okay.
So
abraded away.
That was with our rock abrasion tool, RAT for short.
Okay. Is that like a physical contact or just...
Yeah, just scraping away the surface and making a little circle so that the instruments could look at what's underneath.
Gotcha. Oh, I saw examples of those up front. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. So what's interesting there is that for all the decades before that people had been on the surface of Mars, no one had ever touched the inside of a Martian rock. And Mars having an atmosphere and having a water cycle and having a lot of radiation hit it has quite a bit of dust on the surface, right? Yeah. And it also has the surfaces of all the rocks due to the radiation have gone through physical changes. It's created a patina. So between the dust and the patina, there's actually not as much interesting geological information on the surface. So that's why when we were able to get into the Mars rock, we were able to revolutionize science's understanding of the of Mars geology in general.
Okay. So because I'm thinking patina, just like the Statue of Liberty was bronze, whatever, now it's all green.
Exactly.
If you wanted to sample the real part of the Statue of Liberty, you'd have to scrape away the green stuff.
That's a really great example, yes. If you wanted to really know what it was. Because imagine looking at the Statue of Liberty and seeing it as green, right? Mm-hmm. You would not think to yourself, okay, that's definitely made of the same stuff that our pennies are made out of, right?
Yeah, Planet of the Apes sort of thing. It's in the sand. What is this?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so got to scrape away. So you guys were the first ones. What'd you find?
that is a question more for the scientists, but we found just the type of geology that we found underneath was what was so surprising, like the details of the minerals, the grains themselves.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, we'll pin that there. But found some really cool stuff as you scraped away.
We did, and we anticipate a similar type of watershed moment when we do the first sample of ice on the moon.
So let's talk about it, because I freaking love the moon. My family makes fun of me because there'll be a full moon up and I'll be like, oh, look, there she is. And they'll be like, Vincent, it's not a woman. Shut up. You don't know that. So you guys are going up there. We talked a little bit about Viper earlier, the cool stuff that it's doing, descending into these awesome craters to pull stuff away. Talk to me about the watershed moment. What are you guys hoping, expecting?
Sure. So there is a lot of discussion in the industry right now about what is the ice like? Does it even exist, right? Is it simply a light dusting of snow at the surface, or is it perhaps like a thin sheet of ice, or is it maybe many meters deep of a mixed kind of dirty snowball of regolith and ice together?
Gotcha.
Is it something that we have never anticipated? Like, is there no way for us to describe what it's like until we get there? You know, we don't know, because everything that we have right now is based on orbital data. The orbital data is great. I want more and better satellites around the moon. But until we get to the surface and actually take ground truth measurements, then we simply can't know. So there's some interesting things. We can't, like, sometimes you can infer from the orbital data what's going on geologically somewhere.
Okay.
But sometimes you can't. And in the case of this this lunar surface ice, you can't. One very interesting thing is just a few years ago, they released some new maps. They put together multiple different lunar satellites data and created this very beautiful map of where ice might exist on the moon. The guy who put that together is named Shuai Li. So a couple of years after he put together that map, then he was at a conference and talking, and people were asking him about this lunar ice, like, how, you know, tell us a little bit about it. And he said, one thing that we've realized recently is that it's patchy. And so just saying that, just the fact that he said that it is patchily distributed, it's not evenly distributed.
Yeah.
Everybody in the room was suddenly like you could look around the room and see how taken aback everybody was, because and the wheels started turning about what that means. Like, how did the ice get there? How does that change how we understand how the ice gets there? Room full of scientists and engineers suddenly thinking about the implications. So that happens all the time in science. There's never anything that is like really fully 100% we know this, right?
Sure.
We are updating our understanding, and revolutions happen all the time. So we are very excited to be a part of the revolutionizing of the understanding of the water cycle on the moon.
Fair enough. Yeah, that'll be an exciting time. So, yeah, we know that it's in different patches. I had a professor at the Colorado School of Mines that I've just interacted with him. I haven't taken his classes yet, but Kevin Cannon, he's got all these really detailed theories about what the different ice strata can look like.
Yeah.
I know he'll be watching with bated breath when we discover what are the depths, what is the slurry mix.
Oh yeah, Dr. Cannon is fantastic. I knew Dr. Cannon when he was at UCF. I'm a graduate of UCF myself. If you ever get a chance, he put out an image once. I think right when he got to Colorado School of Mines, he put out an image of like all the different possibilities of how ice and regolith could be like connected, as in like maybe it's like they're glued together, or maybe it's like they're kind of dustily, you know, maybe you've seen that image.
I think I did, over at the Space Resources, like next to each other glued,
right?
Something else,
all kinds of different ways that they could be touching, and how that would, the implications that would have for the distribution. And I think it's a great image, because it really shows clearly some of this kind of convoluted thing that I'm talking about, of how we really don't know what the ice is like. Just those small changes in how things are stuck together on the granular level propagate to very large changes in geotechnical properties.
Gotcha. So one of the things in there is, you know, hopefully the ice is distributed in a way that it doesn't take insane amounts of power, and we can collect it and we can shake it out and distribute it decently easily. That would be great.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the case. Maybe it's not.
We don't know.
Regardless, the moon's going to need power.
Yes.
Honeybee has some plans for that.
Yes.
What are those plans?
We've been working on a vertical solar array for a little while.
I like
it. It's a lot of fun. We were developing quite a bit of the technology related to this solar array even before NASA came out with a solicitation related to vertical solar array power provision.
Mm-hmm.
So we had developed a dust tolerant electrical connector. We had developed a mast, and the mast ended up working very well for what we were doing, a vertical boom, basically, right?
Ship mast.
Like a ship mast, yeah. Exactly. We partnered with a company called Empower Technology, and they had been working on the solar panels for quite a long time, specifically looking at ways of making solar panels that were more flexible and lighter weight than things that had been shipped up before without requiring very exotic chemistries for the solar panel.
Nice.
So it's a fantastic partnership because all of the mechanism work that Honeybee had done in advance, plus all of the solar panel design work that Empower done in advance came together to where we could actually compete with some of the much larger players in the field. So we're competing against Lockheed, Boeing. There are other groups that also won this lunar vertical solar array challenge. So we put quite a bit of our own money into it. In fact, we doubled basically the funding that NASA gave us. That doesn't even include all of the funding previously to get these mechanisms up and running. And we are planning on putting some more money in as well for the phase two. But the reason why we are so committed to this is we think that power provision is going to be one of the key issues early on. In fact, when we talk about lunar permanence, when we talk about lunar science, the main thing is there's no permanent power available at the surface. So when we look at Mars, a lot of those rovers have MMRTGs, right? So they can go forever by themselves. Well,
which is like tiny radioactive batteries, right?
Yes, exactly. They have radioactive batteries. Those are no longer available. We don't have the stuff to make them.
Oh.
So
outlawed or something.
What's that?
Are they like they were outlawed or just not
no,
useful?
No, it's just the material. Like it's not that they were outlawed, but more that the process that made them is no longer viable for like political reasons.
Okay.
There are other companies that are working on nuclear power solutions that do not require that particular radioactive material. They have other radioactive materials that are much easier to source and make.
Gotcha.
But that's a little ways off still. So in the near term, because we're in kind of this quandary when it comes to power, solar power is extremely attractive and is readily available.
It's a lot of it.
Yeah, and we can ship up a lunar vertical solar array with just, all we need is a couple of more years of development on this thing before it's ready for flight. You can't say the same about a lot of the upcoming nuclear technology. So we're hoping that we will kickstart this lunar electrical grid with a couple of these vertical solar arrays, perhaps at the South Pole, maybe going around a key crater.
Yeah.
But, maybe in the future we'll hook up the nuclear power source into our grid as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea of having a mixed source grid is very common on Earth. You know, people,
for sure.
our main grids are run by natural gas or coal, or in some places nuclear, but then almost all the grids have the ability to hook in solar at this point, right?
Yeah.
So we have a model for doing that kind of grid growth. And it's very exciting because once we have the first couple of solar panels put together, the first couple of vertical solar arrays connected, then we will be able to guarantee people that there will be power available. And then all of a sudden, mission planners can do just 100 times more than they could right now. Right now, they're limited to, you know, 1 month of operation tops, basically.
Because then they freeze.
Then they freeze, right. Or the batteries eventually, just run out of the ability to take those big cycles or whatever. You know, there's a lot of reasons why it's hard to go beyond a month.
Hmm.
So this will make all of those problems completely go away. Ultimately, many problems are power problems, particularly with the engineering.
That's fair, because if, like, I have to have component parts that can survive crazy heat and crazy cold... Do you?
Yeah, or you could just have something that has a small heater on it.
That'll work.
Yeah.
Hey, sorry to interrupt you here. I know it's a really cool conversation. Since it's so cool, would you mind taking a second to just give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you use? I really mean a lot. If you want to go the extra mile, a genuine review would mean, like, a ton. All right. Back to space.
So, okay, so two, digging in a little deeper here, because some of the listeners will be deep in the space industry and they'll roll their eyes at this and others won't. Why vertical solar panels?
Oh, it's a good question. So right at the poles, sunlight doesn't come in from up above. It comes in almost parallel to the surface.
Hmm.
So... You and I right now in Southern California live at a place where the sunlight comes in directly at us. But someone living in Northern Norway, for example, some people call Norway the land of the midnight sun. Norwegians call it that, right? And the reason is at certain times of year, the sunlight is out like all the time, right? Like there's sun literally 24/7 for certain parts of the year, right?
And honey, come back by sunset. Sure thing, Mom.
so yeah, the sunlight at that time of year, when it is like the land of the midnight sun, the sun kind of travels along the horizon. It doesn't go over. There is no like high noon at that time of year. It's like it's a different way of thinking about the sunlight. But another way of thinking about it is sun is big, moon is small, right?
Okay.
So the light that is coming from the sun, if it's coming straight out, then you just have to reach above the height of the local terrain to grab that sunlight that is passing overhead.
Fair, because it's shining everywhere.
Right.
Okay. All right. So a little vertical, get up there past the tallest hill.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're on a tall hill, that'll work.
Exactly. Or on top of a spacecraft or on top of a habitat.
Gotcha. Okay. And then other question there. You said the other company that's been working on these solar panels that are really thin and flexible. And what was their name again?
Empower.
You said that they have like simple chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
What's the chemistry in like just those solar panels outside in California?
The same chemistry. So
okay.
What a lot of people have worked on for space solar panels is the kind of advanced complex chemistry. There are upsides and downsides to that, but just silica-based solar panels are useful. They're what we use on Earth, and it turns out that Empower has found a way to make them very lightweight and useful for the lunar surface as well. So it's a benefit to us for sure.
Okay. So one of the stories that I've heard is like solar panels are as cheap as they are now because 20 years ago when we sent stuff over to Mars, we used RTGs and some solar panels, and the solar panels had to be as efficient as possible because Mars is far away. So it didn't matter if they cost $1 billion. Mm. And so those had, I'm guessing, really complex chemistry to get more of the light.
Possibly, yeah.
Whereas the ones outside and the ones going up there, it's 15, 20% efficiency. That's fine with me.
Yep. At beginning of life, something like 20% efficiency is more than good for us.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha. So simple. Okay. So if it's just silicon based, you know, you guys aren't trying to extract large volumes of resources and become those industrialists, I don't think. Maybe. But theoretically, if it's just pretty much silicon based, there's a lot of silicon up on the moon.
Sure. But it's, you know, it's interesting. I don't, in talking about industry on the lunar surface.
Yeah.
I don't foresee a future where there are industrialists extracting large amounts of resources whatsoever. The truth is, I think we're going to be living off the land, and that there, we will reach capacity for how much can be used versus how much we can extract pretty rapidly. So I don't know if there's ever going to be, no one's going to be treating the moon like we treat the Earth. And in fact, I think a lot of the Native American people who practice kind of living off the land now, we can work with and should work with and should model a lot of our techniques and our behavior when it comes to the moon based on what they've been doing for thousands of years, because they sustainably used resources for a long time and grew populations without causing, there have been huge cascading effects through history, but in general, there have not been, especially compared to modern society and like environmental catastrophes, right? So so these methods of using enough to survive, using enough to do what you need to do and not using any more are going to be very useful on the moon.
Okay, but to play devil's advocate, right, the resource consumption that humans have been using has been increasing dramatically over the past X number of years, and standard of living has been increasing. And we like that as humans. And it's like, for example, right, it's two-thirds of the Earth has, you know, access to cell phones but no connection to the internet. And as infrastructure builds up, we get air conditioning in different places, we get tablets and, you know, whatever. People in countries that don't have access to an iPad or whatever, they're going to want that. So does that fall under just something that I need or something that I want? I guess I'm just confused on...
Well, it's okay. It's an interesting question. I think when we talk about what is available and what is needed, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of places on Earth that have food shortages, that have a lack of nutritious food.
Yeah.
There are places on Earth that have people working, 80 hours a week to survive. And one of those places is the United States. Hmm. So I think that scarcity and availability and use of resources are in some ways not a, it's not a clear relationship between what is needed and what is done. We use more resources than, you talked about some of the developing nations, for example.
Sure.
The United States, the average person on the United States uses something like 10 times or has 10 times the carbon footprint of the average person in the developing world, right? Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is if you look at the top 1% of the United States, their carbon footprint is significantly higher, right?
Sure.
So the average is kind of, sometimes they don't always tell the true story, right? Mm. So I actually do think that the amount of resources that are required to be used are significantly lower than what our history would tell us, because sometimes our history is confused by conflating the uses of the resource uses of the average person with the resource uses of the top 1%.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's fair. because private jets pollute a lot. I mean, plane travel in general pollutes a lot.
But a private jet every day? Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's a 747 divided by 300 passengers.
Right.
Divided by four.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a different thing, right?
Yeah.
And also, like, looking at things like military, right?
Sure.
The U.S. military is also factored into the pollution numbers for the average person. Okay. Mm. So there's not going to need to be a military on the moon.
Hopefully.
Well, there doesn't need to be a military on the moon.
Fair. Well said.
I think so. Like things like that are generally unnecessary can be completely taken out of the equation. Hmm. The amount of resources that we will use will be related to two things, sustaining life mm-hmm. and then traveling further.
Okay.
That's what we need, right?
Okay.
There may be rare earth element mining operations or gold mining operations.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there's gold on the surface of the moon. In some places, it's in higher weight percentages, higher ore grade, as it's called, than even gold mines on Earth.
Wow.
Not everywhere on the lunar surface, of course, but in certain places, yeah.
I can shovel, panhandle for gold.
You can go pan for gold on the moon, yeah. So who knows? Okay. We may do some kind of mining operations. It may become economical, but
if we do that, it better look, I mean, by necessity, it's going to look different.
Correct. And it's going to look better than any mine ever built on the lunar surface. I mean, on the surface of the Earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talking about like, for example, rare earth elements, right?
Yeah.
So on the moon, we're not going to need to dig meters and meters deep. We're going to be able to, we're going to be able to mine just certain areas that have definite, obvious concentrations of rare earth elements, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in the past, for example, thinking about like how artesian gold mines worked, right? Mm-hmm. People used to just kind of pan gold out of rivers. They would get gold from the top surface couple of meters from the earth. Maybe they would go down a little bit deeper, but like,
sure.
It didn't really get down into the depths of like, you know, multiple kilometer deep mines. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that, on the moon, it's going to be much more like it was before on the earth than like it is now. We will not need to destroy the surface of the moon to get what we need.
Gotcha. And probably like if there was just the moon, then we would reach a point when we would want to go a kilometer down to get those resources. But the benefit of getting to the moon is you're already out of Earth's gravity well, mostly, kind of.
You've gone a long ways.
You've gone a really long ways. And why scar up the surface of the moon and go really deep when, hey, look, there's asteroids out there that just have boatloads of resources.
Right. The moon is a jump-off point. Exactly.
Gotcha.
It's a way for the moon is a place for us to learn how to treat each other better. It's a way for us to learn how to survive in deep space.
Yeah.
It's a way for us to kind of reimagine what society could be like, and it's a way for us to learn how to in the roughest possible terrain learn how to build what will be useful in the future for mining anywhere else in the solar system.
I love that. And so one other thing on the power side, right? So partnering with these guys, making large boom solar panels, nuclear will eventually be up there in spades.
Sure.
Can't wait. It's going to be great. Talk to me about the power connectors that you guys have designed, because the moon is a harsh mistress.
Yeah.
She's dusty.
It's very dusty. It is dusty. And the dust is not normal dust either, right?
Yeah.
It's made from micrometeoroid impacts. And so as a result, it's very jagged and it can get down to very small particle size distribution. So, So that means it gets everywhere. Tiny, tiny stuff just slips into every crack. Mm-hmm. So we built something where we have a self-healing membrane that the pins pass through. And as a result, the when the two sides of the connector come together and the pins pass through the two sides of the self-healing membrane, the dust is completely wiped away. So it can be dunked into dust and connected, and it will still work. And we have made this freely available to the public. We are releasing this design. We've got it under a Creative Commons license now. So
what does that mean? Creative Commons.
Creative Commons license is a kind of license that basically the one that we have released under says, like, you can use this for free. You do not have to pay Honeybee to use this design. Just let us know, like, cite us if you're going to use this design, and don't change it slightly and then say that you made it and charge $1 million for it.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all.
Fair. So sending that out there to try to avoid the problem of, I have micro USB, I've got lightning cable, yes, I've got USB-C.
Exactly. We said, instead of trying to make money off of this particular, like, you know, of course, Honeybee,
you want to make money.
Yeah, it's a company. It's a company. But instead of trying to own everything and monopolize the, especially because we want to be power providers, right? So instead of trying to monopolize power provision in a predatory way, we want to release what's going to work with our system so that anybody who's building a payload could interface with our system. It's kind of the opposite way of looking at it.
Yeah.
We are kind of like the Android model as opposed to, you know, the Apple model.
Okay, yeah.
So the interesting thing about the lunar electrical grid is that it very likely will not be just one company building it, right?
Sure, sure.
It probably won't even be one country building it. In fact, it may be multiple countries coming together to build it. In fact, this is not a new idea of us coming together to build grand infrastructure as a, you know, as a one human race.
Yeah.
In space, ISS was built by multiple countries, sure, of course, but also even Apollo, they considered for a while putting up a UN flag instead of a US flag as the first flag on the moon. So this idea of the outer space being the shared heritage of man is a common one. Yeah. It's one that has history throughout even our own space program.
Yeah. Well, and there's even legacy of different countries cooperating on power. Especially if you look at like the European Union.
Yes.
Their 2050 plans are, let's have massive connectors between us. Hey, Denmark and other, you guys are really good at stored hydro, pump water up a mountain cliff when it's cheap power, when it's expensive power, release all the water down. Sweet. Spain, you do solar, and France, please keep doing nuclear, such and such. And then they just exchange, sell the power between those. So kind of a similar framework of, let's just lay down the pipes and exchange power between countries and companies, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's as we look towards space expansion, and I am a fan, I'm a believer of the industrialization of the moon. I do want that to happen. It can be done in
a sustainable way.
In a sustainable way, in a way that doesn't scar
The
surface of the moon. It's looked that way for a long time. Let's not screw it up.
Yeah, exactly. We don't need to put advertisements on the surface of the moon.
Please don't.
Right. We have a choice in the way that we set things up on the surface of the moon, right? We have a choice in the way that we build up our industries. And so I think doing it purposefully, conscientiously is important. You know, we don't have to make the mistakes that we made on Earth. And I think it's going to have to actually be different from how we did it on Earth. So the cooperation necessary, or the cooperation that I think will be necessary to make this lunar grid, is just a microcosm of the cooperation that will be necessary on the lunar surface.
Yeah.
You can't have people have mental breakdowns on the surface of the moon, right? So people can't be overworked. You can't have people who are you know, struggling and just being left alone to their own devices to struggle, right? People are going to have to care about each other. People are going to have, to have community. And so things like, you know, bigotry, racism, they can't have a place. In fact, people are going to have to investigate their own internal biases and stuff before they go and live in these very tight, close quarters type places. You know what I mean? Especially if people have like long-term living situations on the moon. And then on the other side, nobody can be like desperately poor on the moon either, right? So we can't have laissez-faire capitalism on the moon. If anybody gets so broke that they can't afford food and they decide, well, and they just give up, like there's no point in doing anything, then all of a sudden you have a big problem, right? Mm. So
how is that a bigger problem than, you know, someone stuck on the streets in LA? Describe the difference there.
It's a great question. I think the main issue is the person who is on the streets in LA does not have the ability to kill everyone in LA by loosening a couple of bolts.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, I think that that is a sad thing in some ways, that like, you know, just because this person doesn't have power over us, we don't take care of them. Because very often you'll even see in cities that have like major programs for getting unhoused people off the streets, right?
Yeah.
Orlando had a pilot program that worked very well for a while. Even like pre-1980s, there were a lot more programs for such things. And so you never saw that kind of thing happening. So it is a modern issue that we have people living on the streets like we do now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fair distinction. And not to get too down into the weeds here, but like, right, with school shootings and things of that nature,
sure.
Like the people that do that are not psychologically stable. And from what I've read and discovered and dug in, the base reasoning behind it is life is unfair. Screw everybody. How can I hurt the world like they've hurt me? It's innocent. I'll attack the innocent. That's how I'll show them. And there's dramatic consequences because of that. However, there's still a lot of steps you have to go through on Earth in order to go to a firearm store and acquire. Yeah, you can order it online, but it's going to ship to a store where they have to do a heavy background check. You have to get that. On a moon colony, if you're pissed,
all it takes is a wrench. Right. And talking about the reasoning behind things like that, you know, it's hard to say exactly what causes it. Why is it almost uniquely American problem, right? And like, what is it in American culture versus other cultures that drives this issue?
Yeah.
So I think that one of the first things we have to do whenever we do have permanent lunar colonies, but all I think especially permanent Martian colonies where there cannot be back and forth, right? You're stuck for at least a year, maybe longer. And that's if you want to go home immediately. There, you know, you very well may be stuck for, you know, 5 years, right? Or longer on the Martian surface if we do that. We have to investigate how we want to set up society and what the problems were back on Earth and how we can definitely not make the mistakes that we make. Because, like, for example, a lot of people have different reasons why they think that school shooters exist, right?
Right.
So I think that regardless of the reason, if we cannot agree on the reason, then we have to try a multi-pronged approach to alleviating whatever things cause it in places like the moon and on Mars. And so that leads to a radical reimagining of society.
Yeah. And it's, I guess, one benefit or one, I don't know how to describe that, but a dramatic reimagining of society. We can test this out. Kind of like, you know, the beauty of the United States is you got federal and you got state. And if you don't like the laws in one state, you can move. And yeah, it costs you something.
I think there's a lot of people who can't move, though.
Okay.
Right? Like, I mean, I know plenty of people who would love to leave. Like, you know, I lived in Florida for a long time. And I think, you know, especially talking about like some of my gay friends in Florida, I think they would love to leave right now, but simply can't because it's financially very difficult to leave. Hmm. So, you know, I don't know. I think there are some good things about having different states, having different takes on things. But on the other hand, I think that we will have space for experimentation with how we set up different societies on the lunar surface or on Mars. But I do think that some things are going to have to be baseline.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's fair.
So I think that, especially like, whatever is going on right now in the United States with, some of the, you know, the discrimination that happens, it simply can't exist. You know, yeah. Another thing that can't exist on the lunar surface is like, maybe you'll be able to have some kind of property rights around what you harvest from the moon, yeah. But you won't be able to have property rights on, the land itself.
Yeah. This is a really interesting part mm-hmm. of the conversation. Cause that's the way the legislation is currently written.
Correct.
And there's very few space lawyers out there. There's more coming into it. And we know that there's parts of the legislation. It's like, all right, that's not applicable to 10,000 people living on the moon. I don't know what the future holds there. Obviously I'm not a prophet. But the idea of you can only own the resources, you can't own the physical land. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a mind trip for a lot of different people.
Certainly.
And not only is it going to be a mental issue, there's also a whole part of like economically, one of the issues that I've discovered in or read whatever, like Native American tribes, mm-hmm. Unintended consequences of legislation. Hey, federal government says we want to protect this land so that it's yours and so that no one else can come and take more of it because you're already reduced down to such and such.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Love the intent. Fantastic. The result of some of that legislation is it's very, very difficult for local tribe leaders, tribe people living there to own the property because it's a collective property owning. And because they can't own the property, if they go to a bank and they say, hey, I want to get a loan to build a house here. Well, what do you own? I don't own the land. And it's a big issue. And there isn't that huge leverage tool that the rest of the United States has to create at least middle class wealth with a home because they don't have the leverage of I own this property.
That's actually a very interesting thing, though. On the other side, what that shows is that the banking system is not made for collective ownership, right?
No.
So if we don't change the laws, which I hope that we don't, I hope that we keep land ownership out of the out of outer space.
Hmm.
But if we don't change the laws, then financial institutions are going to have to figure out how to do that, like how to mitigate their own financial risk,
mm-hmm.
Even when there is no land ownership. One of the things that we have to think about is, especially in the beginning, you send a group of 50 people, right?
Okay.
Everybody's got a job, right?
Yeah.
At what point do you get where everybody's making enough surplus where you could have a psychologist or, you know, a psychiatrist?
Hmm.
At what point do you have enough surplus where you have dedicated medical staff?
Hmm.
You go on and on. How many people do you think are necessary in a habitat to require a real estate agent? you know?
Okay, fair.
A corporate lawyer, right? So I think that I think that quite a bit of that is going to be, you know, handled on Earth, of course.
Yeah.
But my personal opinion is that a lot of the things that we have in society now simply are not going to be necessary on the surface, and that it's a good thing.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. And we go to make it happen.
Right.
Yeah. It's fun to theorize. It's fun to see, imagine what that future is going to hold. And it's even more fun because we're actually going to see it.
I hope so. I certainly do. We're building towards it at least.
Destroys us.
Sure.
All.
Yeah. At least for now, certainly. It's a good question. So I am very excited about people living and working on the moon, especially non-astronauts.
Yeah.
I'm excited about the potential for someone such as myself to be able to live and work in a place where the engineering matters, where everybody's helping one another, you know, where there's no cops. There's just so many good things about living and working on the moon.
No popo.
Yeah, no popo. Beyond that, I am very excited about the technological paths that I see laid out by NASA. At the Lunar Surface Innovation Consortium, they showed what is on the critical path for Artemis and what their envisioned futures are. So including, oxygen production for propellant, water harvesting for a number of different things, from, you know, human use to propellant to cooling. There's so many uses for water, you know, it's radiation shielding for the trip out to Mars, you know. Yeah. There's just so many different things. So I'm very excited about all the different technical avenues that open up for that, just with the extraction of oxygen and water. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, talking about the metal production on the moon, you know, being able to do in-space manufacturing, being able to harvest our metals and build satellites and build huge, you know, huge structures, big spindly structures that we could never build on Earth because they could never survive launch, right?
Yeah.
There's just so many things that, like, you start to think about, and mission planners just, you know, can go crazy with, because there's, you know, this never been possible before. I want to live long enough so that I can see, like, for example, when we have, you know, almost like very cheaply sourced propellant that is very clean from the surface, you know, hydrogen and oxygen is about the cleanest propellant you can get, right?
Yeah.
So when we have vehicles that are built around hydrogen and oxygen sourced from lunar water, then where do we go? Do we start venturing out into the asteroid belt? Do we build a habitat on Mars? Do we start looking at places we've never looked before, like Mercury?
Sure.
I am very excited to see that. So, of course, the near-term stuff of setting up this lunar grid, getting the first group of people on, maybe even myself one day being one of the people who could work on the moon, that's extraordinarily exciting.
Yeah.
But living long enough to see people really start to dream about what we can do in the solar system to truly spread and become not just a two-planet species, but maybe even considering beyond that is, I think, you know, it's incredible that NASA has, like, caught this bug and has, you know, caught the vision that we could do this thing.
I love it. I love it. And it's been an exciting shift that NASA has taken over the past 10, 15 years of we'll just be the vision casters and we'll take our money, most of it, some of it, and say, hey, we want to be able to do this. Who can we pay? I like that model a lot more than the previous of we will build all these different components.
Yeah.
Seems far more sustainable for space exploration because private industry does good stuff.
And one of the interesting things is the NASA, as it is set up, is such that what they really do best is having great ideas and then pointing the money gun at people to develop these ideas, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, and that's a great thing. You can, because I think, you know, if you look at Apollo, the government can do some, like, you know, do it itself and do it fine. But
oh, yeah.
But I think that the way that NASA is structured now is that its skill set, its workforce's skill set is really in that dreaming big and pointing the money gun. So I think that one of the issues in the recent past has been dreaming big and then pointing the money gun back at themselves. Right.
Yep.
So the fact that NASA is kind of looking at other opportunities and considering what is more efficient, mm-hmm. Is fantastic to me. And I'm just glad that NASA hasn't lost its ability to dream big as well, you know?
Yeah.
So, but they got the money, right? Taxes make a lot of money, but having vision is something that is irreplaceable in some ways.
I love it. Final closing thought. Do you have any space tattoos?
Ha! I have entropy.
Okay, that's what that is.
Yeah.
I've been looking at like that out of the corner of my eye. I'm not sure if it can show.
Second law of thermodynamics right here. Exactly.
Nice.
You know, things fall apart. The center cannot hold.
Okay. All right. I've got one tattooed of just a phrase, but don't have any space things on me yet.
Well, there's a new generation in space, right? I don't know if you ever seen that movie Hidden Figures.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great movie.
Very good.
But I just like, I love the fact that, you know, they, you know, these women of color who used to get treated as like, you know, furniture who are actually vital to the mission.
Yeah.
So like it was, there was no reason for them to be treated like that. They were actually really important, but they got treated so bad. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then to look at how, you know, they're like, NASA has recognized that diversity is important, that like a diverse workforce works better. And so like, you know, I am a cisgendered white man. So I'm not the most diverse person on earth at all. But, you know, the fact that like, even, you know, people who look like me and, you know, people who have some tattoos, like for some people that's like, oh, it's, you know, I got tattoos and I can work at NASA, you know, so edgy. Yeah. Right. But, I'm happy that both people like me, as well as people who actually have some diversity, you know, are able to work in lockstep with me on these future visions. You know, doesn't have to be just a club for cisgendered white guys anymore.
For sure. For sure. And there's diversity of a lot of different kinds, right? There's diversity of thought, diversity of opinion. I feel like we've, in this country over the past however many years, we've all isolated. And the red people hang out with the red people, and the blue people hang out with the blue people, and the four green people just hang out and talk about how they can never get their person in office. And it's like, that diversity is really important too.
Well, one of the reasons why I bring up the diversity,
not over important.
Sure.
But
well, the reason I bring up the other kind of diversity is that like at NASA in the 60s,
yeah,
you would find red people, blue people, right?
Sure. Back then.
But the idea of a female deputy administrator of NASA, right?
Wasn't going to happen
in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
So certain, I guess I should say that the diversity is good for having a healthier space program, but also that the more of these barriers that we break down, the more of the kind of bigotry of the past that we release, the stronger our workforce and the more, you know what, I'm going to share one story real quick,
please.
So in one of the earlier missions in preparation for the moon, there was an issue where there was a they were using a pure oxygen environment, right? Mm-hmm. And the door swung inward, right? So when there was a problem and the I think it was Velcro or something caught fire, because in atmospheric conditions where there's nitrogen,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't catch fire, it just smolders. But in pure oxygen, it explodes, right? Yeah. So the astronauts lost their lives, right? Mm-hmm. But what NASA talked about afterwards, when they were kind of reviewing how on earth this could have happened, was that they had an insufficiency of imagination, right? That there was a problem on the rise that they, as a group, when they had their own moment of coming together to review, that insufficiency of imagination of what could happen was a part of the problem.
It's a good phrase.
Right. Yeah. So I think that another insufficiency of imagination that has been a problem in the past has been the insufficiency of imagination of the benefit that you get when you have all of these different kinds of people, you know, these previously completely shut out people from different marginalized groups coming together to work on stuff. These perspectives are valuable, right? Yeah. And so I think that we will, just like when NASA came together after this horrific event, mm-hmm. and made a rededication to more practical imagination, you know, toughness and all kinds of really important changes in the way that they did business, then I think we're on the verge of another new, big, important change in the way that we do business now.
I like it. And yeah, we are, this nation is a melting pot. Mm-hmm. And when we are the most melted of the pot, we're better for it.
For sure.
And we come up with brilliant ideas. And the countries out there that are the size of Rhode Island and everyone looks the exact same, they're not as innovative. They just aren't. And there's probably a lot of reasons to that, but I do not doubt that one of them is we got people from freaking everywhere here. Mm-hmm. And that's a massive strength.
Certainly.
So I love the, have you seen the show The Expanse?
Yeah, I read the books too.
Nice. Yeah, really good books. I got like, I think I did the first two or three. I didn't finish the series. Chris on here before was talking about how when humans go to Mars and they live there, they will be Martians.
Yes.
And their biology will change.
Truth.
And the books go into a little bit more detail of like, they use some special word of like,
Belters?
Well, yeah. The concept of just others. And we are the Belters, and we are the Earthers, and we are Martians. And it's so interesting to me because they addressed racism in such an interesting way. Hmm. Because there's blatant racism in that show. But the color or creed has zero input. It's where are you physically from? Mm-hmm. How much gravity did you have growing up? And there's guys on Mars that are black, brown, purple, yellow, green, like whatever, everything. But they are just very racist against the tall, skinny people that live in the belt. I looked at that and I watched that show. I was like, well, I hope that's not how it happens.
I think one of the main things that The Expanse shows is that it's a science fiction does this very well, right? Where you take existing problems and specify it, yeah, in order to comment on it, right? Yep. And the thing about the Belters is they are the poor, abused workforce, right?
Yeah.
So they are racially different and they are also poor. Mm-hmm. And that intersectional issue of both being being a different race as well as being the poor ones comes together to cause them to be the ones who are most discriminated against, right?
Yeah.
So I thought it was really interesting that like they imagined a future where, you know, I agree, hopefully we don't live in that future, but also one of the commentaries is that the laissez-faire capitalism of The Expanse, right, yeah, leads to a new kind of racism and a new kind of exploitation, right? Yeah. So, we would never, if we had a space society that really that valued human life, right? Hmm. You'd never allow people to become 8 foot tall and unable to step foot on a planetary surface because it would break their bones, right?
Hope not.
We would find ways to help their bodies heal from the effects of of deep space.
Yeah.
So like, you know, maybe spun up rings on all spaceships that would allow them to experience partial gravity, things like that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The expanse's commentary of like, let's avoid the artificial creation of new exploited groups was something that I very much identified with.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed that. And it's possible. The main thing is it's possible, right? We have all these resources that we can get. We have an entire solar system full of, more water, more rare earth elements, more platinum group metals than we can ever use. So much, right?
So much.
So we are not resource limited.
No.
So we have to be careful to not artificially resource limit ourselves.
Mm, yeah. And I think one way that we can avoid both creating that class and artificially limiting resources, they didn't have any robots in that book.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Exploit the robots. They don't join unions. They don't have feelings yet. I hope not. they might come back to bite us, but until they do, right? Like, make a crap ton of robots and send them into the mine. Don't send people.
Yeah, agreed. I think that, you know, what a robot is ultimately is a force multiplier for the value of human labor, right? So, what we can do, and hopefully the lesson that we learned, just like we talked about how certain technology in space comes back to Earth and helps us on Earth, right?
Yeah.
I think one of the lessons that we could very much learn on Earth is, what if we use technology such to the point that instead of everyone having to do backbreaking labor all day, they could do a certain amount of programming and then do other things, right?
Sure.
So I think that using robotics as a force multiplier for labor on Earth is also a possibility. So maybe, yeah, who knows? Maybe we learn how to not work as hard and not have subsistence be the answer to all questions that relate to labor, you know?
right. Well, and we've already seen that. Like there's a show that I really love. It's called The Chosen, and it describes the life of Jesus viewed from the disciples that followed him around, the people.
Interesting. Okay.
Good stuff, really good. And they do these flashbacks from time to time, and there's one that shows the 12 sons that become the Israelite nation. And I was talking with my dad about it, and he pointed out, I was like, well, no, 12 sons was an insane piece of leverage because you had 12 strong bodies to work the fields. Like, yeah, you better become a powerful nation kind of thing, or at least a powerful family. You take that and you fast forward it. As technology advanced, right? So, women's rights suppressed since whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I am stronger, therefore, haha, I win.
Certainly. Misogyny is probably like the oldest kind of bigotry, right?
Probably, yeah. And in a world where strength was the only thing that mattered, it wasn't a correct argument, but that argument was made more easily by a lot of people. Just in our own technological development over the past 200 years, where we now have running water in the developed nation, you don't have to go get that from the stream. Now we have washing machines. You can put it in, you can hit a button, and now you don't have to spend 4 hours. We've got a little robot that comes and sweeps floors. Like all the things that somebody has to do to maintain a house, we're already outsourcing that. I think there's even robots that cut your grass now.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that's not a new trend. It's a trend that's allowed all of humanity to spend more time doing the creative, just fun things that they enjoy instead of just, I'm washing clothes.
Right. It's a really interesting question, right? That we have had many, many very large increases in the force multiplier of technology to the productivity of our labor, right?
Yeah.
So as of yet, we still have people are still on subsistence, even though we've had these force multipliers. So what we need is a social change in many ways, right?
Yeah.
So my hope in part is that the social change can happen within my lifetime, and that the social change can happen, you know, maybe through the earth, looking to how people live it on other planets, right? That would be very cool.
Yeah.
But one thing I know that we can't do is we cannot put the screws to people as they work on the lunar surface in the way that we do on Earth, you know?
Right, right.
Because, yeah, the consequences are just simply too high for that.
Yeah. Yeah. The example of, like, right now there's a, you have to be really well trained, but a deep sea underwater welder.
Yeah.
Where these guys live in a submerged submarine for 3-5 months at a time, they make $300K mm-hmm. in 4 or 5 months, but they're in a tiny submarine with two other people. Their life is hell, and it's crazy dangerous.
Right, you have to depend on your colleagues there, right?
Yeah,
truly, and it's life or death to depend on your colleagues. That's how it's going to be on the moon.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's fun to think about for sure.
Fun.
Well, you know. I like to think that I have the psychological fortitude to be able to do it, but who knows, right?
Right.
So that's why I do as much as I say, you know, we're going to need to have, of 50 people, how many people are going to need to be engineers? How many people are going to be, you know, dedicated to life support, maintenance, things like that, right? Mm-hmm. I do think that mental health is going to be one of those things that's just as necessary as wrenches.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of elements to that. One is having dedicated people that work on it. And the other one is be as healthy as you can.
Certainly. How people set up their day-to-day lives. I mean, that's another really interesting thing. There was almost a mutiny at one. I think it was a...
Yeah.
Have you heard about this?
I have. Yeah. Keep going.
So a group of astronauts went up. And I believe this was actually related to early days ISS, but mm-hmm. it was not publicized at the time. But they had these huge lists of tasks they had to do all the time, right? And like morning to night, they were doing these tasks, and like they really never caught a break, right?
Hmm.
And so if you know a breaking point came where they were like, we're not doing any more of this, right? you guys need to. You know,
turn off the comm.
Right, exactly.
Houston? No, hello?
Right, they turn off the comms, right?
Yeah.
So that is a situation that we can say we've learned not to do that, right?
Yes, absolutely. Give people their rest time. Get some green plants in there to make them feel a little better.
Exactly. These things matter.
They do. Brother, well, it's been an awesome afternoon. Thanks for a good conversation,
man. Absolutely. Thank you for talking. Yeah. I'm glad you got a chance to talk to me and Chris. It's Chris is the visionary. I'm just the guy who's doing the things in his wake. So,
hey, you need vision, you need strategy, and you need someone turning wrenches.
Right. Agreed. Totally.
Love it. So.
All right. Cool.
Peace out, everybody. Go enjoy some blue sky, because there's not a lot of that in space. It's really good for your health.
Truth.
Okay, bye.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. Next time, we'll have Chris Zachney on the show. He's a VP at Honeybee and does an incredible job articulating the vision and strategy of Honeybee. We look forward to seeing you there. If you like the show, do us a favor. Leave a review, drop a comment if you're watching this on YouTube. If you have any friends or family, like any friends or family, send them the show. Come on. It's interesting stuff we're talking about. And that's one of the ways that we get the word out, by people like you. If you want more updates from the CisLunar podcast team, check out our website at cislunarexp.com. So cislunarexp.com. Because, you know, that's a lot of letters to spell out cislunar experience. I misspell experience all the dang time. So, website cislunarexp.com. That's where we're posting some blog posts, some travel updates for the show, because we go everywhere, and a store in the not too, too distant future. Thank you so much. Now go get outside. get outside. It's great. It's beautiful. You could be trapped in Nova Scotia, and you're not. Go get some sunshine, and don't forget to aim, and aim high. We'll see you next time.